You know how you always make fun of me for being old?
Yes.
I'm starting to believe it. And it's not a complex you're giving me. I'm starting to do things that make me feel old. So in the past month, mm-hmm. I have walked into not one, not two, but three screen doors. Like, I just did it again about an hour before this. And I make fun of people so hard when they walk into glass doors or screen doors. It's my favorite thing in the world, but I'm starting to do it. And I did it on set. We were in San Diego filming right through a freaking investigator's screen door, like, and the door bent, mangled it, right? Come back here, back home, right through the damn door. There's three giant rips in the screen. I'm like destroying screen doors left and right. So I must be old. I'm going to just admit it now.
I think you need bifocals. Maybe you can't see the screen.
I think it's because it's the time of year where every time I see a door open... No, you know what I'm saying?
Like old man eyes.
But like in the winter, you open the door and you go out and you close the door. So the fact that I see a door open, I just think it's open. I don't think of a screen that could be in there.
Yeah, but see, now we're getting into what your wife hates when you just leave the door open. Like you were.
But when she's not here, that's the thing. She wasn't here. So I can do what I want. So I close the door, figuring Brenda will yell at me if I don't close the door. And I walk face first into it. I had a big cut on my nose. It was ridiculous.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to another episode of Murder Unscripted, episode 69.
I think it's episode 70.
I think it's 69. I'm just saying.
I think you just want to say 69.
Shut up. I'm your host, longtime television producer Ed Hydock, along with The Wind Beneath My Wings, Melissa Spivey. And you can see who wrote this intro.
It is about time I get the credit I deserve.
Yeah, well. So I do have a few things I want to mention before we jump in. So first of all, as we announced earlier this month, we are starting a Patreon. And for people who don't know what a Patreon, like if just YouTube audience may not know what a Patreon is. So it's basically a paid audio subscription, like through the podcast platforms, right?
Yes.
I thought you'd have more to add.
Do you want me to explain?
If you'd like. I mean, you can... There's going to be tiers, right? That's how it works?
Yeah, there's going to be different tiers. And it's actually, you can get the Patreon app, which is a whole separate app. You can connect with creators. You can do, there's all sorts of different things you can do, which is why we're trying to figure out what we want to do. So that's why we need your help.
Absolutely. Well, it was brought to my attention that not everyone may know what a Patreon is for the people that just watch on YouTube. So thank you for explaining that more than just, yeah.
Yeah, that thing. It's an app. It's fine.
It is an app. So. We are starting that in January, and we definitely want to hear from you guys. So please, please, please let us know what you want to hear on the Patreon.
Yeah, let us know.
Well, you absolutely know where to find us at this point, but Melissa will remind you at the end. And while you're shooting us a DM or a message, please take a second to rate, like, subscribe. You know the drill. Do the things.
You get it. You get it. We don't need to tell you. Well, today we are going to be jumping into part two of our coverage of the Yogurt Shop murders that occurred back in December of 91 in Austin, Texas. And if you haven't listened to part one, you definitely need to hit pause and jump back to last week's episode, or this might not make any sense.
Yeah, this will have a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, just for a quick recap, Sergeant John Jones responded after Austin Fire Department found the bodies of Amy Ayers, sisters Sarah and Jennifer Harbison, and Eliza Thomas. The four girls were naked, bound, burned, and all shot in the head execution style in the partially but extensively burned out, I can't believe it's yogurt shop. And from that first night, Sergeant Jones, his partner Mike Huck Huckabee, and their entire task force, they really worked tirelessly to collect and preserve as much evidence from the scene. But of course, it was so heavily damaged by fire and water. Mm-hmm. So it was tough to do that. But in addition to that, they conducted countless interviews. they obtained an insane amount of false confessions that I didn't know so much about. And that was wild when we were finding out about that last week.
Yeah, because you presented it, so you must have known about it.
Well, I mean,
you can't find out things that you read.
No, I meant like I didn't know about it before we started talking about it.
Oh, all right.
Like, I didn't realize what the number was, how many false confessions they got.
I was like, you wrote it. Like, it was fun to learn about that.
We talked about that last week. We talked about that Sue wrote it. Well, and actually, Mike Huckabee, he even ended up traveling to Mexico to interview three men that had been arrested by the Mexican authorities for the murders. Mm-hmm. But yet again, another false confession and another dead end.
I thought that for sure that those guys were going to be the ones.
Well, by May of 1994, the Austin Police Department, they really started recognizing the burnout of their officers, and they officially disbanded the task force and reassigned all of the original detectives to completely different units. And when we covered this last week, I presented it, and I really wanted to focus on the story of the girls, the details of the crime, the girls' families, and the detectives. But this week, I'm going to kick it over to Ed, and he is going to dive into the timeline, but focusing more on the boys, because really, when we get into this case, it's almost like two separate stories that have ended up all like intertwined with each other.
In the TV world, that's called parallel editing. Like if you have a story that has two timelines that kind of merge at some point, it's kind of what we're doing here. Like you're telling one side of it and then you hear the other side and eventually all the stories come together at the end. But the more you know.
The more you know.
Well, the way you just described it is actually a really good way, because this is almost like some kind of weird, like parallel multiverse plot twist, like a Romeo and Juliet maybe, or West Side Story, like not the love story part, but the fact that there's two different groups living in the same area. And what I mean is the girls, you have these four smart, hardworking, ambitious, beautiful young ladies who come from good, loving families, had great heads on their shoulders, had dreams, had goals. They were fully ingrained in this farming and cowgirl Texas lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But the story I'm going to get into today is like the polar opposite. It's about the boys, we're going to call them, which they're four young guys. They're not great students, lesser by way of means and family dynamics. And all of them are kind of outsiders or like into that Austin counterculture that Melissa, you told us all about last week, the PIBs, Indian broadcasters.
Yes. The PIBs, people in black.
Yes. Yes. So the boys that we're talking about are Robert Springsteen, who is 17 years old in 1991. Michael Scott, also 17 in 1991. Maurice Pierce, who was 16. And Forrest Wellborn, he was 15.
Wow, I didn't realize how similar in ages that the boys are to the girls. Like,
yes.
Jennifer and Eliza were both 17. I think Sarah was 15 and Amy was the youngest. She was just about to be 14.
Right. But that's what I'm saying. Like, this is one of the things when we talk about the boys are almost parallel or opposite universe to the girls. They're like negatives of each other.
Right.
It's wild. So there's definitely not nearly as much information out there about the earlier years or the family lives of these guys as there is for the girls. So, and that's for fairly obvious reasons. Victims always get the full coverage. One of the other reasons is the families have remained kind of private over the years, but Beverly Lowry's book, Who Killed These Girls, provided a lot of information, and we definitely recommend that book if you're looking for more details. We can only cover so much in an hour, but things that are out there on the internet, you can totally find.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to start with Robert Springsteen, because honestly, we have the least amount of information about him before December of 1991. And the HBO docuseries interviewed two women that knew Rob back then, and they described him as, quote, creepy AF, end quote.
Fair.
Like he was kind of the outlier of the outliers. And they also said, and I'm sorry for this quote, but he looked like someone who'd show you his dick in a parking lot. So, Melissa, as someone who I assume has seen plenty of parking lot dicks, can you picture this kind of guy?
Absolutely, I can. I'm well-versed on parking lot wieners. I prefer to refer to those guys as Pickle Park Perverts.
Oh.
Yeah. It's kind of my nickname for them. But
that's pretty good. I like it. Anyway, I do know that his parents were divorced and his mom was living in West Virginia. And Rob was, I'm going to say, living with his dad. But technically, his dad was living in apartment 129 and Rob was living in the apartment next to him. And before you make any comments, Melissa, you know that this is one of those facts that Sue dug into. So you got to hear me out. This address is publicly available, but since there are active listings on Zillow for this apartment complex, we're not going to dox the address. I mean, that's messed up. But unit 116 is currently listed as one bedroom, one bath, and that's approximately 545 square feet. And unit 207 is also active and listed as one bed, one bath, and approximately 712 square feet. So I'm going to guess that unit 129 is probably close in size. And by renting two units next to each other, it's pretty close to having like a, you know, 1100 to 1400 square foot house.
That makes a little bit more sense, because at first I was like, hold on, I don't think this kid at 17, like, it would be pretty cool, but maybe not the best parenting choice out there to let your 17-year-old live alone.
Hey, if my family didn't live in the home that we do, I would absolutely be willing to take a second look at renting an apartment for them. How cool would that be?
You could send the kids out to the treehouse, though.
I could. That's pretty tight quarters, but they'd survive.
They'll be fine. It's fine.
But in all seriousness, no, I don't really know why Rob's living situation was that way. I know he had unofficially dropped out of school at this point. He didn't have a job and just spent his time kind of waiting around for rides, hanging out at the mall, drinking and smoking, and just, quote, looking for trouble to get into, end quote. And we all know that idle hands are the devil's workshop. And I also don't know exactly why, like, if it had been pre-planned or what, but shortly after December 6th, Rob actually packed up and moved to West Virginia and lived with his mom for a little bit. And he seemed to do at least okay for himself. I'm not sure if living with his dad helped breed this bad behavior, or maybe he was a bad influence. I'm not sure.
Or living in his own apartment at 17.
There could be that too. But you'd think if your dad was next door, you could only get away with so much.
I don't know.
What do I know? So let's talk a little bit about Forrest Wellborn. Again, 15 years old on December 6, 1991, and Forrest was dubbed the quiet one by the other guys. It reminds me of the Beatles. Like, they all have a, he's the quiet one, he's the cute one. Like, is that too old? Am I dating myself?
The Beatles? How about, like, NSYNC?
Because I don't know anything about them. Did they have the different ones?
Of course they did. That's the whole point.
Who was the fat one?
Stop talking about Joey. He was the hot one that nobody else thinks except for me.
Well, when he was in the first grade, his parents divorced, and he unfortunately spent a lot of time being shuffled around from one house to the other. And it sounds like there were step-parents in the mix as well, so just a quiet kid kind of going along with what the adults in his life were telling him to do. And his mom ended up moving to Lockhart, which is about 20 miles from Austin, where he lived with his dad. And his elementary teachers remember Forrest as being quiet, which we just said, so that makes total sense, having a major lack of attention span when it came to school. He would kind of just sit in the back of the class, kind of rarely looking up or listening to anything that was going on, because he would be totally obsessed with drawing these like superhero versus villain kind of scenes in his notebook. So by the time he was in high school, Forrest had grown his hair pretty long. And from the outside looking at him, it seemed like he was giving up kind of any hope or ambition. You know, that you see long hair and you just think, this guy's going nowhere. So he pretty much had spent his time hanging around drinking beer. And the only thing he really had going for him was that he was pretty good with cars and seemed to be very mechanically inclined. So it's a shame he didn't put that to good use, because if he would have had a focus, I feel like he could have turned his life into something better.
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of Eeyore, if we're being honest. He wasn't very good at talking to girls. He managed to get arrested while sitting in a car waiting on a friend who went into a convenience store and shoplifted a 12-pack of beer. And then I'm not entirely sure if this happened before December of 91 or after, but Forrest managed to rack up a ton of traffic tickets. And instead of getting a job to pay the fines, he went on the run to Lubbock. He started living in an abandoned family trailer there. So I don't know. I feel like this kid had some talent. He just needed some ambition and motivation.
Well, I mean, I'm assuming he went on the run, did super well for himself, and became an upstanding citizen.
Oh, well.
That's obviously.
Clearly, yeah. Well, now I want to tell you about Michael Scott. And yes, Melissa, like The Office, Michael Scott.
I just keep seeing Prison Mike in my head.
Prison Mike.
The Dementors.
Well, okay, we'll call him Mike Scott then, just so you can get that out of your head. I gotta say, this guy's a pretty interesting guy, to be honest. He was actually born in Micronesia, which is where his family settled after his grandfather served in Guam during World War II. And his family moved around a lot when he was younger, and eventually they made their way to Austin, Texas. And Mike was diagnosed when he was fairly young with severe dyslexia, which made school an incredible challenge for him. But as a younger kid, it didn't really stop him. He was a Boy Scout, and he stuck with it. He became a Life Scout, which I can tell you, I'm actually an Eagle Scout. Did you know that about me?
I did, yes.
Okay, so Life is the one right before Eagle. So he made it pretty far. And
wow.
He did that when he was 16. Yeah, so he was actually like a year ahead. So through his freshman year, Mike actually had his hair pretty short. He played the viola in the school orchestra, and he made the football team, and he even joined the school drama department. But by his sophomore year, his parents ended up getting a divorce and his mom was suffering from a variety of emotional disorders. So he was really struggling to keep up in school, and by all accounts, he just kind of gave up on everything. He quit all those activities that we just mentioned. He let his hair grow real long, like down past his shoulders, and started dressing like he really just didn't care about anything. And I guess the divorce hit him pretty hard. And I know some kids, that happens. Mike's grades tanked completely. They were so bad that he had to redo his sophomore year. Now, at that point, he was like skipping school all the time and actually moved in with Rob in early November 91 and fully embraced the quote unquote do nothing boys title that Sergeant John Jones would eventually give them. For real, though, they were like doing nothing except hanging out, drinking beer, doing magic mushrooms and dropping acid. So maybe not nothing. They're doing something.
Tons of stuff. Nothing productive, but still stuff.
Right.
That does suck, though. It seems like he was on track at one point to becoming, like, a good human.
It does. And the stuff that he was involved in, he was on the right path. So I don't want to blame the divorce, but it sounds like it came at a time that wasn't going to be good for Mike.
Yeah.
So this is the part I found really interesting, and maybe it's because I'm in my 40s and not a 17-year-old teenager anymore, but at the time of the murders, Mike was the only one of these four boys that had any real interests. He was actively involved in a branch of Explorer Scouts, which was dedicated to the study and dress of pre-1840s Native Americans. He was taught how to make his own, like, tan hides. He would craft his own leggings and breeches, and he would make accurate dance outfits that he would perform in. After that, he would later join a medieval reenactment group. So, I mean, this guy was, like, into the theatrical element, and it sounds like he really knew some cool stuff.
Two things. A, that's really cool that he did that. It sounds very interesting. B, who says britches? How old are you? Britches?
Too big for your britches? That's an expression.
1903?
I used britches. You'll have to ask Brenda. I used that the other day in conversation.
Oh my God. Swear to God. I'm so embarrassed.
Text her without my knowledge. Did Ed say britches the other day?
I'm sorry you're dating this geriatric old man. That's why I'm going to text her.
We've been married 4 years, so.
Oh, married. She likes to block it out. So,
to round out this group of boys, we have to talk about then 16-year-old Maurice Pierce. And hearing about this kid, the dad side of me just kept coming out and saying, like, if I was his dad, I would have seriously considered sending him to the military, like, without question, based on some of the things that he did. And again, I don't have a ton of information to paint the whole picture of who this kid was, but I'll start off by saying that he usually is called the ringleader. So pretty much anyone the police ended up speaking to about Maurice, they heard that the most important thing to him were cars and guns. It sounds like he got that from his dad, who was notorious for buying, selling, and trading out cars on a regular basis. But he was also a pretty big gun enthusiast, too, so maybe that was just trickle down from his dad.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, Maurice was the one that always had access to a car, and he was really strict with anyone who rode in the car that they keep it immaculate.
Just like my car.
Melissa, your car should be how it's roadworthy. I don't know where you pay for your inspection stickers, but.
Oh, I just don't get that done. It's fine. If you don't get it done, they can't tell you.
It's a post-it note. You wrote 326 on it.
Just duh. What's the problem?
So Maurice, he was described as a grifter, and he's the guy that would, like, steal your dog, wait a while, and then return it for the reward money. Like one of those guys.
I'd slit his throat, but okay. Yes. Go on.
Well, of all the four boys, Maurice is the only one to have ever been in any, like, serious trouble with the law. So in 1990, when he was 15 years old, Maurice was picked up by the police twice for unauthorized use of a vehicle. Once because someone had left their keys in the ignition of their car. So Maurice, of course, what do? You jump in, take it for a joyride.
If they're there.
Well, yeah, right? So he drove off with his car. And another time, it was when his dad had reported him for driving his dad's car to Houston. So he almost, like, stole his own dad's car. But while he drove it back to Austin without issue, his dad still called the cops because, quote unquote, he shouldn't have done that. So he was trying to teach him a lesson.
Yeah. Just kidding. Oh,
wow.
Well, no, I would have snitched too.
Totally. Well, also in 1990, Maurice was suspended from school for fighting and having a knife on him. He was also arrested that year for stealing fire extinguishers. Just weird stuff with him.
That's so dumb.
So in early 1991, Maurice was charged with criminal trespass when he jumped the fence of an apartment complex with a double-edged knife in his belt. And he was also arrested for possession of a stereo that was believed to be stolen, arrested again for criminal trespass when he ended up in a schoolyard and threatened a student with bodily harm by bombing, and an additional arrest for assault. So, class act.
This kid just sounds like a douchebag, like a loser kid who's, like, trying to be tough. And, like, I feel like this whole thing is some bad teenage rom-com. Like, we have the good girls, and then we have the boys from the wrong side of the track. It's like Claire and Bender from The Breakfast Club, although none of these loser boys can hold a candle to Judd Nelson.
Well, yeah, and I feel like they're not cool bad. Like,
no, that's what I mean. They're like nerdy bad. Like,
yeah, which is not attractive.
No.
I imagine. I'm not attracted to bad boys, so I wouldn't know. Seriously, though, the girls and the boys, they were living such opposite lives. It's wild. So, like you did last week, I'm going to start off with what we know. And for total transparency with you and our listeners, I can't say for certain that all of this is in fact true, because a lot of it comes from interviews years after 1991.
Okay.
So at 8:44 a.m. on December 6, 1991, Robert Springsteen Sr., so we're talking about the dad now, had made a call to Austin Teleserve. And this is a service provided by the city to report issues that maybe you don't want to bother police with. So maybe things that don't require me, like a non-emergency line, I guess. And you can get the police's attention because you file a report. And what happens is they basically follow up with you when they can. So I would assume it would be something like, someone stole a plant off my porch. I just want to report it. Something like that. So Robert Sr. calls in to file a missing persons report saying he hadn't seen or heard from his son, Robert Jr., since 10 p.m. on Wednesday, December 4th. So Rob and roommate Mike had not been to school the day before, and school confirmed they didn't show up for the morning either. So for the rest of the rundown on how December 6th was spent by these boys is from a compilation of police interviews ranging from 1991 to 1999. So again, a lot of stories change, things change. So we're going to try to get it as best as we can, but this is what police went with, so that's what we're going to go with. So Mike had said that he got up that morning, smoked a joint by the pool in that apartment complex that they were living in, and then he took the city bus and just rode around aimlessly to see what was going on, frittering the day away.
As one does.
So he ended up at one of the high schools around lunch period, and he wanted to talk to a girl that caught his eye. But in a different interview, Mike said he got up and went to school at 8 a.m., talked to Rob in front of the school, but wasn't sure how he got there. A very weird statement.
Yeah.
So Mike told Rob that he would be at the bowling alley at lunch. So they ended up leaving school with Maurice and Forrest around 2:30 and went to Capitol Bowl to have lunch. And this particular bowling alley had a sign that said kids 18 and younger have to bowl, buy food, or leave. So they must have had a problem with kids around his age.
Where
it warranted a sign. So they didn't hang around long, and Mike left 30 minutes later, but instead of going back to school, he went to the North Cross Mall. And if you remember, the girls had gone to the North Cross Mall earlier.
Right.
They're not totally sure which one of these accounts really happened, but the thing that all the boys seemed to agree on that day is that they all did end up at this bowling alley to have lunch. And Forrest went back to school to finish his classes, and Rob was talking to this girl, trying to make plans to meet up later that night. And Maurice, like always, had a car, so he, Rob, and Mike managed to score a 12-pack of beer and drank them on the way from the bowling alley to the mall, where Maurice dropped Rob and Mike off because he had to go run an errand, something. He had places to be.
Mm-hmm.
So Rob and Mike actually remember having a pretty good buzz by the time they got to the mall. So they went to the food court, just sit around, sober up, get something to eat, and they waited basically until Maurice got back. And they told detectives that Forrest ended up showing up there, and the three of them watched girls, talked to other kids who were also hanging out, and honestly just hassled shoppers and various mall employees. Like, really asshole behavior.
Yeah, so just being douchey teenage boys.
You think that's douchey? Well, Maurice had gotten back to the mall by 4, then they all went to Hooters.
That's the only way a girl's gonna pay any attention. They gotta pay her.
Exactly. They do have good wings, though. I'm not...
True.
All things aside. So, the last thing all these four boys seemed to agree on is that Maurice couldn't stay too long because he had to go babysit his sister's kids. And he asked Forrest if he wanted to go with him, which made Mike and Rob annoyed because that would mean they're stuck at the mall without a car. And remember, Rob wanted to go meet up with that girl that he was talking to at lunch. So now the only person with a car is choosing to leave. And they're like, well, now what? Well, Maurice and Forrest left, promising to come back afterward. And Rob and Mike were basically stuck at the mall, pretty much being a pain in the ass to everyone around them. And this is where we start to get a different version of how the rest of the night of December 6th went down. So Rob said he snuck into the midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show like he always did on the weekends. But Mike failed at getting in and he had to wait in the lobby until 2 a.m. They were hoping to go to a cast party they heard about, but when they couldn't find it, some dude dropped them off at Mike's mother's house because it was close to where they were.
These kids need a hobby.
They run around town just looking for trouble, it seems like.
Where are your parents?
In apartment 107. Where?
Get it together, Mom and Dad. You guys are shitty. I'm saying it. I don't care.
Yeah. So Mike said that they went with Maurice down to 6th Street and they partied like everybody else. And then Maurice dropped him and Rob back off at the condo by 10:30 or so. And this was really early for them, especially on a weekend. But they turned on the cable TV and they watched. Do you remember Kevin Costner's Robin Hood?
Yes.
That was a pretty good one. But they watched that until they both fell asleep. And Mike mentions that Rob actually fell asleep first. That was part of the statement. Maurice's version was pretty short, though. He said, quote, "We messed around, partied. We went down to the fungus. Forrest borrowed my gun, went off with some skinheads, and came back smelling like hairspray, got home and crashed," end quote.
First of all, what the hell is a fungus? And second of all, what? Like, why were they being interviewed? Like, Amy and Sarah were at the mall around the same time, but we didn't come across anything, any witness statements about the girls interacting with these boys. Like, where'd they come from?
So I combined their version of that day from all of these interviews, and now I'm, like, going to explain how these guys even got onto the radar to begin with.
Okay. But I still want to know what the fungus is.
So I called Sue about this. I called her today and I was like, what is this, a typo? And apparently she thinks, to the best of her knowledge, that they're describing this little hole in the woods where everybody would party. So maybe that was called the fungus. I was like, all right, maybe there's fungus there.
Gross.
So the weekend after the murders, Forrest and Maurice ended up at the mall again. But this time, gun-loving Maurice was being honestly pretty stupid because he had a loaded .22 caliber gun in the waistband of his pants and extra bullets in his pocket. Like, he wasn't hiding it at all. And it was definitely, like, waving it enough to draw attention from people and ended up getting arrested for it.
An idiot.
So now, just the week before all of the four girls had been shot with a .22, of course Jones wanted to talk to the kid being brought in for having the same caliber gun as one of the murder weapons.
Right.
So Maurice is interviewed first by Detective Hector Polanco, whose interrogation techniques are a little, we'll call them unorthodox, leave it at that. So Maurice spends 3 to 4 hours with Polanco before Sergeant Jones gets brought into the interview. And when Jones comes in, he asks him about, he said, "What do you know about the yogurt shop murders?" And I'm going to summarize from the transcript that interview. So Maurice said that on Friday, December 6th, he picked up Forrest from school at 4:10 p.m. They drove around for a while and Forrest said, "Let's get the gun." So they went to Maurice's house and they got the gun out of his closet. Maurice put it in the glove box of the car and they went to his sister's to babysit her kids. And then they went to the mall around 7:30 p.m. So Maurice put the gun in his pocket just to be carrying it. He just wanted to show it off. That's
cool.
I can picture the kind of kid this is.
Yeah.
Just with statements like that. So they end up seeing some friends of Maurice's and they all go outside to some trails and to shoot the gun. They just want to go play around. And then they eventually go back to the mall, but this time Forrest put the gun in his pocket when they got out of the car. So Maurice went into the bathroom and Forrest went somewhere else with the gun. And when he came out, he saw Mike and Rob still in the mall sitting outside a cafe. And he asked them if they saw Forrest, and he said, "Yes, we saw him go out the door by the theater." So Maurice said he went back outside to look for Forrest and even drove around looking for him, but he couldn't find him, so went back inside the mall. So by 10:45, he basically went out to sit in his car, just waiting for Forrest to show up. And at 11:30, Forrest did. He just appears and gets in the car, and he hands Maurice the gun and said, quote, "I did something." And Maurice asked him what, and Forrest said, quote, "Me and Mace did something." And I'm like, who is Mace? So looking into this little bit, there was this guy named Mac Larkin. He was like a Creek person. Creek people were like counterculture, you know? So, but apparently this guy hated Maurice with a passion, this Mace guy. So it's interesting that his name would come up. Remember that. So again, Maurice asked, "What did you do?" But Forrest never answered. So Maurice also said that Forrest smelled like hairspray and he noticed a piece of skin on the side of the gun, which I thought was weird. It's like, how do you even notice that, first of all?
Oh.
Right? But he assumed it was from Forrest's arm where he had a scratch. He had this big scratch on his arm. So then Maurice said he drove out to the south side of the mall by the theater to get Rob and Mike since that's where he left him earlier. And they went driving around and ended up going back to the trails to shoot the gun because Rob and Mike, that's what they wanted to do. So Maurice tells police that the next day, his dad actually needed the car. So he and Forrest, they saw this goldish tan Pathfinder with the keys in it. So naturally, you steal it.
Obviously.
Don't take a bus or anything. So they drove it around for a while and ended up getting Mike and Rob. And when they got back to Austin, Maurice dropped Rob and Mike off at Rob's apartment. And Forrest asked if he could borrow the gun. And Maurice told him no and asked why. Forrest said, I want to do what I did last night to kill some more girls. So it's a strange statement to make. So Maurice obviously says, like, shut up, you didn't kill no girls. And mm-hmm. Forrest says, yes, I did. I got a hold of one of the girls and I f***ed her, end quote.
Ugh, all four of these boys are clearly white trash, and there is no way that any of those beautiful young women would have ever given these losers the time of day.
Could not agree more.
Not in a million years.
Could not agree more. Like, there's a difference. We just talked about this, bad boys versus what these people were.
Yeah, they're just f***ing losers.
Yeah. So for Jones, this was a pretty big lead in the case, so he decided to have Maurice wear a wire to see if they could get a confession from Forrest on tape. So Maurice grills Forrest about what he said and, like, wanting to use the gun. But all Forrest kept saying was that he was just playing around. He's just joking around. No big deal. But one weird part of the conversation was when Forrest said to Maurice, how could I have killed those girls? I was with you that night. Wasn't I? End quote. So Maurice said, yeah, except when you slid out. And Forrest's tone changed immediately. And he got, like, more adamant that he didn't have the gun with him then. And I know this is very complicated, but we wanted to make sure we brought you guys the stuff that came from the police report and how these stories, we know it can be tough to follow, but hang with us.
Mm-hmm.
Sergeant Jones ends up bringing Forrest in to be interviewed, and one of my favorite quotes from Jones is, quote, Forrest, he couldn't organize a two-car parade, end quote. So that's how Jones describes this guy. So he said there was no way Forrest would have been able to hold it in, basically a secret like this, especially because they had Hector Polanco, the other detective, and two other seasoned homicide investigators that were very good at interrogations in that room. So as far as Jones was concerned, this was just one of the many false confessions made over the years. And with no evidence to connect Forrest Wellborn, Jones and the task force move on.
I mean, I know what ends up happening, but at this time, if I was the detectives, I think I would have been very torn on whether or not they did it. And I did watch most of the documentary, and I would love to know, though, in real life, what they think happened.
Yeah, I feel like they make for really good suspects, but do they make for good suspects because they're just a bunch of degenerate weirdos?
I don't think they're smart enough to pull
this
off.
I was just going to say that. Like, I think they're good people of interest, but that's where it ends.
I would love to know where that gun is, and, like, because apparently there was skin on it. Like, why could that not have been tested?
Like, but also, how do you know it's skin? Like, I think that's a weird thing. If I saw a gun and something on it, I don't know if it's
big flap of skin? Like, that's disgusting.
It'd be a big flap to notice.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump forward a little bit to 1997. So this is 6 years after the attacks. And remember, Jones had been removed from the case because it took a toll on him. They disbanded this task force. So Paul Johnson has taken over as the lead investigator. And after reviewing all of the original files, he realized there were some major differences between the recorded interview that Polanco had with Maurice and the written statement that was taken by Jones. And the written statement only talked about Forrest, but the recorded statement, Maurice talked about Forrest and also this guy Mace. Remember I brought him up? So he talks about the creek people and also a spot in the around the creek where everyone would hang out, which, just for clarity, this was behind the strip mall where the yogurt shop was.
Oh.
And so this is a creek with, like, trees around it. It was a big hangout spot. And I think that's what the fungus might be. And yes, back in the 90s, kids just like these four guys that we're talking about would go there. They'd hang out. They'd drink. They'd smoke. Basically, they didn't bother anyone, but no one came to bother them either. So it was just an out-of-the-way hangout. But the recorded interview is where Mike and Rob got mentioned. So Johnson decides that Jones must not have cross-checked that written statement with the verbal statement. So Johnson was basically going to start over. Then he goes to find Maurice.
My God, this is already confusing enough. But what is happening in Austin in the 90s? You got the PIBs, you got the Creek people. What is going on?
And then all those people that were waltzing in and out of the yogurt shop.
And then the people and the perverts in the pickle park. You got so much happening in
There's
Austin.
A lot going on in 90s Austin.
Wow. But wow, it wasn't the motto, like, keep Austin weird. You guys succeeded.
Nailed it, Austin.
Job well done.
Quite the melting pot. So this could easily be a three-part case if we went through all the details. But, like, you see how confusing it already is just with these two. But just to keep us on track, so Johnson saw the difference in Maurice's stories as the best uninvestigated lead that they had. So Johnson goes to Maurice's home to try and talk with him, but he didn't get very far because Maurice simply said, I don't remember that night, because we're 6 years out now.
Mm.
So Johnson moves on, and he starts making calls to Rob, Mike, and Forrest as well. And Johnson didn't get a whole lot from the calls, but the guys basically alibied each other with some slight differences in their stories. They all admitted to getting in the stolen Pathfinder and the next day finding out about the girls' murders in the newspapers.
I do feel like, though, the fact that the stories were mostly the same but just a little bit different works in their favor, because if it was too perfect, exactly, or if it was a lie, they wouldn't have been able to get the majority of it correct.
I completely agree. There's too many little fine details to get four of these idiots to remember at the same time.
Right. And especially if they were doing magic mushrooms and acid and God knows what else.
Well, and that's the thing. Maybe when he says, I don't remember that night, he could legit be telling the truth.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. So Johnson does track down the other two guys from the creek that Maurice had brought up and interviews them. And he doesn't believe that they had anything to do with it. So he really focused on those four boys that we've been talking about. So I'm going to do my best to give you a kind of a high-level overview of these interrogations. The info's out there, and I definitely recommend watching the doc and some of these interrogations, but they are tough to watch, to be completely honest.
They are.
So on November 3rd, 1999, Forrest Wellborn is brought in, and he admits to stealing the Pathfinder and going to San Antonio with everybody else. And he was very adamant that he didn't kill the girls, and he was pissed that Maurice ever mentioned his name to the cops to begin with. And I would be too.
Well, don't run your mouth and brag that you did yet. Like, I know. Come on. Karma. You deserve it.
Right. So on November 9th, 1999, Mike Scott comes in, and over the next 5 hours, he was questioned about the murders. The cops were really leaning into saying things like, come on, Mike, you know what happened. Like, you just have to remember. And Melissa, we're going to act out this next part. So I'll send this little blurb here so we can read this like a script.
I got this.
Okay, so I will be... I'll be the cop. You be Mike.
You want me to be Michael Scott? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what she said. Get it?
Mike, we're here to help you remember.
Maybe a bunch of memories will trigger.
Whose idea was it to take down the shop?
Idea? Maurice's idea. He needed money. What have I done? Just blocked it out of my head?
Look, we'll help you unblock it, okay?
I hope so.
And end scene. But it feels icky, right?
Yeah. But it's very leading.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So now it was time for Johnson to head to West Virginia and bring Rob in for questioning. And frankly, his interview was just as gross. Like, Rob started off by telling cops that he had moved to West Virginia 2 or 3 weeks after the murders happened to live with his mom. And he told them that he had gone to see the midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show, which the Mall Theater did play every single weekend. And it, I don't know if you're familiar with Rocky Horror, but it has this cult following where, like, people would dress up as the characters and go watch the movie. I remember I never did it, but I had a lot of friends that did.
Yeah.
And they'd kind of act it out, sing the songs in the theater. But the cops lied to Rob and said, no, you didn't. Theater didn't show the movie last night, which started to make Rob question his own memory. And he stayed strong for a while. Like, he kept saying, I didn't kill those girls. I didn't kill them. And he kept asking, like, almost demanding to be given a lie detector test.
The problem is, we have to get rid of all of our options. I cannot give you any more truth than I've already given. Where do we go from here?
Why can't you? Because you're going to dig yourself into that thing? Well, you're already there. You've already dug the hole. The hole's there.
Oh, I'm in it. I don't know. That's what I keep telling you guys. I mean, my God, this was 7 years ago.
But this is one of the most significant things that ever happened in your
life. That's what I keep trying to explain to you. If I was there and I partook in this, I would remember these things.
And you do remember these things.
No, I don't. No, I do not.
Now, you're the coldest guy I've ever talked to in my life. Are you a cold-blooded murderer?
No, sir, I'm not.
I think you are. I think Maurice is absolutely true about you.
Well, then...
You're the coldest guy I've ever talked to. Pardon me?
Then let's take whatever actions we need to take. If that's what you believe, and that's where you think this case needs to go, then let's go there.
We don't want to go there.
But I'm doing everything I can and have exceeded my limits of helping you guys. Where do we go now?
So the cops, like, kept wearing him down with things like that. They would say things like, what Maurice did shocked you so bad, didn't it? And when Rob, like, was doubting himself, he was like, wouldn't I remember if I partook in this? And with a gentle tone in his voice, Paul says, you were there. You watched it. So at this point, just like Mike Scott, Rob Springsteen confesses to the murder of Amy, Sarah, Jennifer, and Eliza.
What did Marie make you do? Would I create? Huh? What did you do? The best one, the worst one I have. whole mood, and then felt, what?
Wow.
Where? I wanted to turn that way. Where do you want to?
I'll show
it
down.
Do you want me to go up? What else? Did they get off? No. Well. Where are you? Okay. You get in. You're there. And on our bed. One bedroom. Don't have
you. Thank you.
I didn't say it, but that's scary.
Yeah, I had a lot of feelings on this. I don't like it. I don't like, though, that Rob took off after 2 weeks to live with his mom. I think that's shady AF.
I do, too.
But I also don't like that this is, they're basically feeding him lines, or like feeding mm-hmm. him his memories, I guess.
Well, can you imagine how prolific this crime is in Austin? I mean, talk about one that people in the community want to see solved. And now we're mm-hmm. 6 years out and it still hasn't been. So the pressure on police to solve this was probably, exponential, you know?
Yeah. And here we are 30 plus years out and it's still not mm-hmm. solved.
So they were, if there were some shady tactics employed, I mean, they were probably just trying to put a bow on this case.
Yeah.
So obviously news of these arrests make it back to Jones, and all he could think was, all right, that sounds good, but like, where's the evidence? You can have all the confessions in the world, but do they mean anything? Mm-hmm. Because all you've got is a confession of two guys now who, as adults, are living these quiet lives with their families, not to mention zero physical evidence connecting them to this crime. Even with what I would say is a weak case, the state went ahead charging Rob and Mike with murder, while Forrest was charged with party to robbery. And Maurice was arrested too, but I don't actually know what his official charges were.
Hmm.
Oh, and remember the former cop turned security guard that you told us about last
yeah.
week?
Yeah.
They showed him 9 pages of photos to see if anyone looked like those two guys that he was focused on that night, and he didn't pick a single one of these four boys out. So there's that.
To me, that's one of the biggest things that points to them not being the guys. And eyewitness statements are generally a disaster. I know that. But in this case, that guy did this for a living. And he was like so adamant about like watching the movements of like yes. the people he saw that I feel like he, out of any eyewitness you could ask, he would be the one that I would take what he said as gospel.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you would think he would know approximate height, he would be getting eye color and hair color and all the clothes, and he would have a full description of these guys. And if he didn't see them, I kind of believe him.
Right. I agree.
So Forrest was actually let out on bail 2 months after his arrest, and he was offered a deal if he would agree to testify against the other three guys. And Forrest refused the deal, saying, I'm not going to lie. And he ends up not being indicted and walked free. So with no confession, though, and no one to testify against him, all of the charges against Maurice Pierce ended up being dropped, and he too walked away. Although he was never exonerated by police, and they were convinced that he was the mastermind of all this, but bottom line is he got out. Rob and Mike were not as lucky, though, as the state moved forward, and they were both to stand trial for the murders of the girls, and if found guilty, they could be given the death penalty.
Wow. And it's wild because, to me, Forrest was the one who made the comment about killing the girls.
Right.
Like, I almost feel like Rob and Mike weren't a part of that. Like, I don't know. It's so weird how they narrowed it down to them.
It could have been their tone. It could have been just the way they said something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's things that go on behind the scenes that we don't know.
Yeah.
So Robert Springsteen's trial was first, and the state relied heavily on this confession, despite the fact that he recanted it, as well as the statements from Mike Scott that he made to police, which were carefully redacted to protect Mike's Fifth Amendment right. So anything Mike said about himself was removed from his statement. So only statements about Robert were used. And on May 30th, 2001, Rob was ultimately found guilty and sentenced to death.
Wow.
And for Mike Scott's trial, the state relied heavily as well on 20 hours of interrogation footage, his confession, and the statements that Rob had made to police, which weren't redacted in any way. Since he already had his trial, there were no Fifth Amendment issues. So on September 22nd, 2002, Mike Scott was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison because the jury couldn't reach a unanimous decision on the death penalty. So he got the LWOP.
That's wild. And like, you know, I love me a good LWOP for the worst of the worst, but a death sentence and an LWOP with really no evidence just doesn't feel right.
It doesn't. Like, you can't go putting people to death over a confession. I don't care if it's the most notorious murderer. You better have evidence to back that up.
And for these guys to have 8 gajillion false confessions and then to take that one as, like, the truth? Like, why that? Would you pull that one out of a hat?
I guess because it's the most, the closest to maybe what actually happened based on timing and location and all that. But it's super fishy.
Yeah.
And guys, there really is a lot more detail about everything having to do with the tactics that police used to get these confessions and why they were probably false confessions. There's just a lot of details out there that some of these missing pieces of evidence from the scene, and like the lock on the back door was gone. No one could ever find that. So if you want to deep dive into this, definitely check out the book that we referenced, Barbara Lowry, and also watch that HBO docuseries. It's very, very well done. And it gives some great insight that obviously we can't compete with an HBO doc. But for the sake of time, I'm going to jump forward in the timeline and just encourage you guys to check it out for more details. Check those sources out. So remember way back to the earlier part of last week's episode, Melissa, when you told us about how Jones and Huck were really forward-thinking and making sure that these girls' bodies were swabbed for DNA collection. So in 2008, the samples that were collected were able to be tested, and a partial DNA profile was found. And here's a shocker for you, that DNA profile did not match a single one of those boys.
That's insane. And at this point, they had been in jail for like 5-6 years now?
Yeah, by 2008, yep.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and you would think that would be enough to get him out, right?
Well, right.
It was not. And until the next year, when in 2009, when Robert and Michael both had their convictions overturned, but not because of the DNA profile, but on a violation of their Sixth Amendment rights.
Oh, that amendment. Mm-hmm. For people who don't know it, maybe you should tell people what the Sixth Amendment is.
Why don't you tell? You don't know it either.
Obviously, I know, but I don't want to make you feel bad. This is your episode.
I so don't think it. You know. Well,
I think I know everything.
So, looking it up, the Sixth Amendment guarantees rights to people accused of crimes, including the right to a speedy and public trial, an impartial jury, being informed of the charges, the ability to confront witnesses against them, the right to call their own witnesses, and the right to have a lawyer. So because neither Rob or Mike had the chance to face each other during their trials, because they had invoked their Fifth Amendment rights to stay quiet and you can't incriminate yourself, so hence the convictions are thrown out.
I feel like that speedy trial is kind of a joke these days, but okay.
you should look into it. I mean, some cases, yes, some no.
Some cases, yes. Like, how about all the ones that got delayed for COVID? It's like now 100 years later, and they're like, we're finally getting there.
COVID was a special time. So back in 2009, the DA's office tried to say some pretty stupid stuff about this DNA. So they said it could have been cast off or transferred DNA, like it got into the girls from the water that they used to put out the fire. But they were still sure that they had the right guys and would be moving forward with this new trial. But as both sides were preparing to go back to court, DNA technology continued to develop, and now people were using YSTR testing. So police tested literally every single man that they could find that was at the shop that night, like all the firefighters, all the police officers, all the first responders, and no one matched. So obviously that DNA transfer theory was getting a whole lot weaker. And then when they deep dive into these police interrogation techniques, not to mention the lack of like physical evidence, the DA ultimately decided not to pursue a retrial. Instead, he was like, let's wait until there's a confirmed DNA match. Like, maybe they'll get one in the system at some point, but they haven't to this day. The charges were all dismissed against Rob and Mike. And now I think they're just kind of waiting to see if someone surfaces in a database.
Yeah, that's a dick move, though. Like, the DA at this point, they know they didn't do it, and they can't even, like, exonerate or at least dismiss without prejudice so they can move on and not, like, worry about being arrested again. Like, you're wrong. Be a man or a woman, whoever it is, and admit it. You messed up. Everybody makes mistakes. I get it. But you messed up. Let these guys go.
Yeah, and as much as we all want it, just based on their criminal history and the douchebaggery. Like, I feel like we all want to hate them, but that doesn't make them murderers. And
no.
Maybe they are and they just haven't connected them yet, but DNA does not lie. And if their DNA was not at the scene, I don't know what else you need.
I know. But I also feel like this case has been so bungled. Like, I don't know that it's ever going to get solved.
It's hard. Again, having that water poured on the scene, I think did a lot of damage.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to say that it might have been done for the family's sake. And I know we're talking about this pretty positively, and I don't want anyone to think we've forgotten about the families or the girls. And because I can't even imagine what they must have gone through. I mean, this is an awful, horrific, tragic crime that absolutely changed the fiber of Austin, Texas. But they've waited for years to find out who did this and to go through the trial and to think that closure was on the horizon because the monster that killed your kid is like no longer out there, just to have it all ripped out from under you. I've interviewed families that have gone through this, and to know that it's not these guys had to be a serious gut punch.
No, I agree. I'm not necessarily sold one way or another on Maurice and Forrest, though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what to think about them either. And unfortunately, we're never going to really get to know because Maurice actually died in 2010. He was being pulled over for something simple. It was like a traffic stop or something, but he ran. He decided to flee, and he was chased down during a struggle with the cop trying to get him on the ground. Maurice actually takes the guy's knife, the cop's knife, stabs him in the neck. And thankfully, the cop survived, but Maurice went on the run again and was eventually tracked down by officers on the scene who opened fire and hit and killed Maurice.
I mean, you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. Sorry to be a dick, but I'm not going to lose sleep over him. He wasn't an upstanding citizen. You're going to stab a cop. You're going to run.
Yeah, and this guy was like a career degenerate. So, I mean, I'm sure he had plenty of reasons to run from police. But, I mean, that's what happens. You're going to get shot.
Sometimes the trash takes itself out.
It's true. Well, I go back to why the police ever even talked to these boys to begin with. Like, Maurice got arrested for being stupid and having a gun at the mall the week after the murders. He was starting to rack up a pretty lengthy rap sheet for only being 16. He just thought he was super cool. Like, he had this cool car, probably thought he was smarter than the cops. So there's a possibility that he just, like, told them this story, like, throwing Forrest under the bus, thinking they're going to look at Forrest, like, realizing he, forget about me, I didn't have anything to do with it, and he won't get in any trouble. But on the other hand, did Maurice ditch Forrest at the mall that night, meet up with those other two guys that were at the shop at closing time that no one has ever identified, like, being a part of this? And because all his friends were usually drunk and major stoners, told them what happened, and, like, that's their version of the events now. Like, get a few minor details wrong, but, I mean, could that be the reason for all this?
Yeah, there's a lot more to unpack here, like, about all of it, but I don't know. It really comes down to when this DNA profile is identified, I think.
I completely agree. I think that's what it's going to take. But to let people know where the case stands now. So as of 2021, a guy named Dan Jackson took over as the lead detective for the Yogurt Shop murders. And I want to mention that when you walk into the Austin Police Department, the cold case unit, so right in front, they have four frames up. And it's a photo of the girls and kind of a little blurb about who they were. And on the table is a 3D scale model of the crime scene, which I did put some pictures in part one. So you've seen that already. But it's something that APD sees and thinks about every day. Like, even when they walk into this day, that stuff is still there. And we've learned from all the detectives, how many cops did we interview that said, I keep a picture of so-and-so on my desk. It's either a case that meant a lot to them or one that's unsolved. And Jackson still has continued to have evidence evaluated to see if additional DNA can be found, because technology is constantly growing, constantly developing. So I think one of these days this is going to be solved, but only once that profile has a name attached to it.
That's wild to me that it's almost like with the Darlene Krashock story about how that guy committed that horrible, brutal, disgusting murder and then never did anything again and took that long.
Isn't that wild?
Like, this is going to have to be solved by genealogy. Like, where's my girl, Colleen? Hit her up.
I know, bring her,
we got
seriously.
This. They were all such good girls. Like, not that bad people deserve to be murdered either, but, like, these girls would have done something. So many of the people that we cover, like, they would have gone on to do something so great. And these girls just had such good heads on their shoulder. They were smart and beautiful and just had so much to give. And then this, and it all just got so bungled. Like,
It really
is the case that haunts so many people. People
absolutely.
Who have nothing to do with it. People who weren't even born in 1991 know about it.
I know. And I absolutely hate leaving you guys without a closure to a case. But this one was too, it fit our format, what we were doing in this block so perfectly that I thought we'd bring it to you. But a wild story, a sad, tragic story. And I do hope this one day sees resolve for everybody involved.
I hope so. I think it's going to have to be genetic genealogy. I think that's the only way it's going to get solved.
Well, hear me out. So Rob Springsteen is the senior, the dad, seventh cousin of Bruce Springsteen. So maybe it's going to match Bruce Springsteen. Where was he
you
on
only
December
know that
6th?
Because I told you that. And also, I concur. Where was... You know what? This is not the first time Bruce Springsteen has come up in this podcast, which I don't even like him. But don't you remember, he was in my episode about the Jersey Shore Thrill Killer.
Oh, that's right. When he released his album, Jersey Shore? What was the album?
Greetings from Asbury Park.
Greetings from Asbury Park.
You know, where that's he's right. from. Good one, Bruce. Creative.
Look, you know what? Greetings from your town.
Next, we're going to find out Bruce Springsteen's Zodiac. What is happening?
Man. So that is it for this week, you guys. Thank you, Sue, for helping to put that together. I know this week was a little confusing, but it was important that we told you the boys' side of things, too, because they were the major suspects in the case. So I feel like it's important to learn a little bit about them, especially because they were tried and then not.
Yeah, and actually, in the HBO documentary, the one guy, Rob, he's like the first scene of the doc, he's in it. It's actually when he's going to like his hearing to be deemed not guilty, I guess, because he wasn't exonerated, so I don't really know what to call it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he's in it. But I do recommend you watch the documentary. It's long, but it definitely has a lot of really good information.
Yeah, and it'll really help clarify the story to see things with it. Like, a podcast is tough when there's just names and dates and places.
But definitely have a box of tissues, because it's really sad and really depressing. It's so good, but it's so sad.
Yeah.
But again, our theme of the case that haunts me will really hit you if you watch that documentary.
Yeah, there's not going to be many happy cases in any, really, that we do. But
true.
Yeah.
Well, let us know what you think about this case, and let us know what you think about Patreon. You can hit us up at our email, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. You can get us on all of our socials. So many. I'm not even going to name them. Just go to one of the socials and type in Murder Unscripted.
You'll find it.
We're probably there. Or you can hit us up on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
That is it. Those are the places.
Yeah, those are the places to be and be seen.
Yes. So, what do we got next week?
What do we got next week? We have another case that haunts me. Oh, next week is brutal.
Yes, it is brutal. And this would probably be a good time to tell everyone, too. We've been teasing our guest for a little bit. And we actually teased her months ago. And then she flaked on us. But she didn't.
Yeah,
she
and so we family. Tease her about that.
she had a family emergency, but... Shannon Byers. She worked for the medical examiner's office in Gwinnett County, Georgia. I forget what month we talked about this. Oh, it was in our spring cleaning. Yeah. So she's going to talk to us about first responder trauma. And that's the stuff that we've been hinting at with this whole block. Like, the people who have to see these things first on the scene, the firefighters, the first emergency personnel, EMTs, the people who show up before any, like, the nitty gritty investigation starts and just has to witness death. They don't really get to see, like, work the case. They just see it and move on to their next grisly scene. So you're going to hear about how it really takes a toll on people to the point where you don't always get to do what you love anymore because it beats you up so bad.
Well, and I think it's got to be hard, too, to be the first people there because no one can give you a warning like, hey, this scene, really rough. X, Y, and Z happened. Mm-hmm. Like, you just have to go and that's it.
And see
you're
the
there.
Things you see, like, right?
Yeah.
So she's
stay
got some
tuned
really,
for that.
Yeah, she's super cool. And she's the one who's been helping us with Reddit and all the other things on the side. So she's a big fan and we're a big fan of her. So I can't wait to bring her to you guys.
Yeah. So until then, stay safe, stay hydrated. And remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
No. And they all apparently gather at yogurt shops because this story has more perverts than potential.
And at
perverts.
The pickle park was me.
Yeah, that's
my hangout, guys.
Goodbye.